Well, good morning, everybody. We're in a series on the first chapters of Genesis. What happened last week was that Adam and Eve were punished for their disobedience and distrust of God. They've been driven out of the Garden of Eden. Our story picks up where they live in exile east of Eden. They start having babies. In this story, we hear about two of them, baby Cain and baby Abel. Brothers, how sweet. Can't you just picture them running around together, playing catch, climbing trees, hanging out with dinosaurs, just having a really good time? I'm joking there. I'm not going to ask you to deal with the faith and science issues today. I just thought I'd throw that in. But then Cain and Abel grow up. They go to different colleges and choose different career paths. The text says Abel was a keeper of sheep and Cain a tiller of the ground. So Cain is a farmer who sets up on a particular plot of ground and puts a fence around it and starts growing stuff. Abel is a shepherd who owns flocks and guides them around the countryside looking for food and water. This is my rather rudimentary understanding of these two different professions, but let's go with it for now. Anyone who has ever seen the musical Oklahoma knows that the farmer and the cowman should be friends. You all need to have sung that with me. I would know that you are a musical theater aficionado. The farmer and the cowman should be friends. The reason you need to sing that the farmer and the cowman should be friends is that sometimes these ways of life are in tension with each other. And scholars believe that that is maybe part of the backstory behind the Cain and Abel story, reflecting tensions in the time that the story was written. In any case, tension has arisen in the first family, sibling rivalry. I wonder if there's anybody in this room who has ever experienced sibling rivalry, either in your own childhood, or perhaps you're living through it now, or your children or grandchildren. I remember growing up in Northern Virginia, Vienna was the name of the town. The family across the back fence had four brothers and a sister. They were all between the ages of 12 and 18, as I recall, the story that I'm about to say. I used to hang out with them. They were great to hang out with. They had a basketball court in their backyard. We used to play basketball and wiffle ball there. They had every board game. We could play football sometimes in their front yard. But what I mainly remember about this family is that these boys especially were constantly competing with each other at everything and constantly breaking out into fights over this or that dispute, usually involving the shedding of blood. This was a daily occurrence. They had parents, but like in Charlie Brown, the parents do not appear to have played a role in their lives. They were on their own. Now, I remember that Liz, the only sister in this motley group of brothers, learned to survive somehow. She was one of the toughest young women I have ever met in my life. I believe all five of these young people survived to adulthood and went on to have successful lives. But anyway, I digress. So the next move in the Cain and Abel story has often puzzled readers. It says, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground. Abel, for his part, brought of the firstlings of his flock their fat portions. The Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering, he had no regard. Why does God like Abel's offering and not Cain's? It's not really clear from the text, though maybe we get clues. Cain's offering may not compare in its level of seriousness to Abel's offering. The language of first of the flock, fat portions, may signal that Abel went a little further, dug a little deeper, but it doesn't really matter. What matters for the story is that Cain is enraged. Enraged. It says, so Cain was very angry and his countenance fell. Anybody in this room ever been very angry? Where your countenance fell. Now, of course, what is a countenance anyway? That's not a word you run into every day. You don't often say, excuse me, it looks to me like your countenance has fallen. David Tyler, how's your countenance? You good up there today? His countenance just fell because I just called his name, but before that, everything was good. So, countenance falling. How about his face darkened? His skin reddened? His brow furrowed? He glowered? How about his visage was transformed by anger? I just made that up. I kind of like that one myself. You know, in relationships, there are many times when people get angry. It just happens. Anger happens. It's part of life. Am I right? What matters is what we do with our anger. What matters is what comes next. Here is what comes next between Cain and God. The Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry, and why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? If you do not do well," notice this, "sin is lurking at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it." I think this is the most important line in this story. It's so profound. God here notices that Cain is angry. They've not had a conversation. A conversation is not needed. God's intimate knowledge of his creatures is again reinforced. God sees us and knows us. God knows us better than we know ourselves. God sees inside our hearts. Here God seems to plead with Cain, "Brother Cain, don't be angry. Don't glower and frown. Go get him next time. It's okay. I can be trusted. If you act right, if you do right, I will accept you. But if you continue on a spiral downward, watch out, because sin is lurking at the door. Its desire is for you." It's so amazing, that line. Don't miss it. It's so penetrating. It's so true. Sin is personified here like a lurking beast. Its desire is to have you. Sometimes translated, its desire is to devour you. To devour you. Picture a scary, hungry animal right outside your door. Kids, you got a scary, hungry animal in mind right now? Really scary? Good? Okay. Right outside your door. Is it a wolf? Is it a lion? Is it the New England Patriots? Is it perhaps a serpent? Whatever the animal is, it sees Cain as a tempting, tasty meal. I was trying to think of the scariest animal I could share with you today, and to continue our theme from last week, I'm going to go with the Eastern brown snake, pictured here, I believe. The Eastern brown snake is so deadly that 1/14,000th of an ounce of its venom can kill an adult human being. The teaching here is that human beings are prone to temptation, to a temptation that lurks outside the door of our hearts, kind of like the Eastern brown snake, and that wants just a little bite of us. Right now, in this story, Cain's temptation is rage. Rage. That might not be your temptation right now, this week. Maybe your temptation is alcohol or drugs. Maybe your temptation is greed. Maybe it's apathy or a hopelessness. Maybe it's arrogance. Maybe it's lust. Maybe it's racism. Maybe it's indifference to other people. You fill in the blank. I'll fill in the blank. Whatever it is, it's lurking at the door. Its desire is to have us. But the text says, but you must master it. You must master it. You must master it. Such a profound teaching. There is nothing here like, "Oh, the devil made me do it." We are being taught in this story moral responsibility. There's an acknowledgement that there are beasts inside of us and there are beasts outside of us, and our hearts are dangerous places, and there are temptations that are very grave for each of us. But we must master them. instead of surrendering to them. We must not see ourselves as passive victims of our lives, passive victims of our temptations and our circumstances. We must master them. That's the teaching. And it's a very demanding one and a very challenging one, but a very needed one. I remember back in a previous place counseling with a couple that was really in trouble. They were married, had little kids. The woman counseling would describe angry outbursts from her husband on a regular basis, extremely angry. And when he got angry, he would say all kinds of really memorably hateful things. And the man acknowledged that he did get angry sometimes, but he would say, well, you know, once in a while, I just lose it. You ever heard that phrase? I just lose it. And what he was doing there was to say, well, you know, I'm not really responsible for what I say to my wife when I'm angry, because when I lose it, I am no longer responsible for my own words. So it's like they don't really count. What she's supposed to do is remember, oh, he's just lost it, so nothing he says matters right now. How does that work? Words are like daggers. It doesn't matter whether we've lost it. If we hurl them, we have hurled them. Am I right? He didn't apologize for his pattern of anger. He didn't say, I should stop doing that. He said, I've lost control, and when I lose control sometimes, I am not responsible for my actions. So just don't worry about it. It doesn't work that way. In our story, Cain is about to just lose it. Or is he? The next move in the narrative, I noticed this week, the text itself contains a dispute about what happens next. There is what's called a textual variant in the ancient translations of the Hebrew Bible. Listen to this. The New Revised Standard Version, which we read today, following most ancient translations, reads, Cain said to his brother Abel, let us go out to the field. And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. A good reading here communicates diabolical premeditation. Let's go out to the field, brother. Would you like to go out to the field with me, brother? I've got some things I'd like to talk with you about, brother. So he's luring Abel out to the field so that he can kill him. It's premeditation. But other texts, and the Hebrew text, at least the Masoretic text, which is one of the readings, says, when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. So in other words, there's a dispute in the textual tradition as to whether there was premeditation or not. I think that the reading we have is the better one, that Cain plotted to kill his brother. He didn't just lose it. He said, come on out to the field and let's talk it over. And then they're out in the field, and then Cain says to Abel, hey, look over there, did you notice that? And when his brother turns his head, he bashes it with a rock or something, and that's it, and his brother is dead. I think it was premeditation. Cain has not mastered his anger. He has been mastered by it. He's been bitten by the venom, and it has spread all through him. And it has been now spread to the death of his brother. This, in the Bible, is the first murder. This is fratricide, brother killing brother. We know instinctively that all murder is wrong, but when people kill their own family members, it's especially appalling. We've been reading about that in the newspaper here recently. An appalling crime for Cain to do, or anyone to do. It's vicious, it's irrational, it's stupid. And look what's happening here. Cain kills his brother not because of anything that Abel has done, but because he's envious of God's response to their offerings. This is displaced rage. He can't get to God, and so he lashes out at his brother. And now there's just one brother, and there's an angry and sad God. The Lord said to Cain, where is your brother Abel? Last chapter, we heard God ask Adam, where are you? And God already knew. Here God asks Cain, where is your brother? And God already knew. But the questions ought to resonate with us, and they are intended for us. So I ask you, and I ask myself, where are you in relation to the God who made you? Where are you? Imagine God calling your name. Where are you? Where are you? And where is your brother? Where is your sister? Where are you in relation to the people in your life? Cain's response is defiant. He says, I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? And God's answer is devastating. What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground. Your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground. The belief in the ancient world was that the soul of the person was in the blood. So to shed somebody's blood and have it drain out into the ground, that's where their soul is. And so I think it's meant fairly literally, the life of the person is crying out from the ground, what have you done? And that makes me think of the world in which we live, in which there's been an awful lot of blood poured out into the ground. Some of you may know that my doctoral dissertation was on the Holocaust. I focused in that dissertation on Christians who rescued Jews from the Nazis and their collaborators. During that time, I had many opportunities to travel, to go to sites, and to get a feeling for where things happened and what happened. I visited camps like Dachau and Buchenwald and Ravensbrück. I went to places like Warsaw. And most memorably, I twice visited the Auschwitz-Birkenau concentration camp in Poland. This was the single largest killing center that the Nazis created. While wandering the grounds of that devastating, horrible place, this verse came to mind, your brother's blood cries out from the ground. Over 1 million Jews and others were killed at Auschwitz-Birkenau in 4 years, and they were never buried. And you walk that space and you hear the voices. The reason the blood of over 1 million cried out from the ground there is because there were not enough people who acted as their brother's keeper during that time. When the Nazis were building up towards genocide, when they were targeting Jews for racism and propaganda and legal discrimination and violence and loss of citizenship and loss of employment and marking with the yellow star and putting people in ghettos and arresting people and deporting people, all along the way, there were some opportunities to say no and to stand with Jewish people, but not enough did, and not enough intervention happened, and a whole lot of people were murdered. In my research, though, I discovered probably as many as 250,000 people who rescued Jews, who risked their lives. And I talked to the guy who runs the office in Jerusalem that explores rescuers, like who they were and what they did. He told me that he thought that they helped 250,000 Jewish people survive, a one-to-one ratio. And that reminded me of the line in the Talmud, he who saves one life saves an entire world. So what do we make of this very sad story of fratricide, of a brother killing a brother, and then taunting God as if God does not see or does not know or does not care? And then a God responding both with judgment and with mercy to Cain. I offer, I think it's 6 or 5 takeaways to wrap up this morning. The first is this: the problem of violence is important to God, and it needs to be important to us. It is featured as the first major thing to go wrong after the exile from the Garden of Eden. Murder, in a sense, is humanity's original sin. It is at least the most important wrong thing that a human being can do to another human being. The blood of all of this world's murdered people cries out to God from the ground. Did you know we have a crime victim support group that meets here? And in the Atlanta area, every year, there are so many murders The main thing that that group does is to deal with dealing with murder. We had a worship service here earlier this year in which hundreds of people came out who were relatives of murder victims. Do we care? Do we understand how deep is the problem of violence in our world and in our society and in our city? A second takeaway is that all murder is fratricide. All murder is the killing of a brother or sister, because in biblical terms, we are all family. We are all in the family of Adam and Eve, you might say. That's a point that was made in the New Testament as well. We are all made in the image of God. Every life is infinitely valuable. We all share a common humanity. There are no lesser children of God, no lesser human beings. There are no strangers. And there are no people whose lives don't matter to God. So all murder is fratricide. A third takeaway is that murder has its roots most of the time in anger. Jesus knew this too, which is why he taught about guard your hearts. Check your anger. Don't escalate with name-calling and hateful speech. Seek reconciliation. Forgive those who have angered you. If you can, at least try. Seek reconciliation. You go up the ladder. Cain didn't begin with murder. He began with rage. Where's the rage in us? Fourth, anger, like many other phenomena or sins, wants to master us. But we must master it with God's help. I think of every human life as being a daily contest over who or what will rule. Who or what will be in charge? We become what we choose to do each day. If we give in to anger on a regular basis, we become angry people as our character quality. Oh, I know that person. They're angry all the time. So maybe it's that, or maybe it's greed, or maybe it's something else. What we're trying to become is somebody who looks more like Jesus, who chooses the good, who clings to God, who does what is right, who resists evil. Anger wants to master us. Other kinds of sin wants to master us. With God's help, we don't have to be mastered, do we? I don't think the message of the gospel is just forgiveness. I think the message of the gospel is forgiveness and transformation. Fifth, we are our brother's keepers. We are responsible for each other, beginning at home, with our spouses, with our children, with our extended family. You know, there are a lot of homes in which violence is characteristic of that home. Violent words, violent actions. We must refrain from violence in our homes. We must learn to live in peace at home and far beyond. And then we must look around us and ask, who else might be vulnerable? Who else might need an advocate? Whose life is being threatened? Who can we concretely offer help and protection to? This takes us out into hard questions in community. Who is dying unnecessarily? Who can we protect? Who must we resist? Who threatens others, and who needs protection? And so you have to pay attention to criminal justice and global affairs and poverty and war and all kinds of issues if we know that we are our brother's keepers. And then finally, we are reminded that Jesus is the Prince of Peace, and every baptized person has promised to follow him. So we don't really have any choice. If we have promised to follow Jesus, we're going to have another baptism next Sunday, by the way. If we have been dunked in those waters, we have said, I will follow Jesus, who taught justice and peace, who taught forgiveness and reconciliation, who loved his enemies even when they took him to his death, who died for our salvation but did not kill. We are his people. We must follow him. And when he teaches us to dig deep and forgive and reconcile and make peace and love our neighbors as ourselves, we have already pledged to do what he said. My prayer is that we would be that kind of community here and that we would bear that kind of witness out in the world. Are we our brother's keepers? Cain intended it as a taunt to God. Not my problem. God's answer is we are indeed our brother's keepers. And it begins at home. And so now the invitation of the church is extended to anyone who feels called to make a response. Maybe your response is, God, help me not be so angry. Maybe your response is, I need some transformation. I need some Jesus in my life. Or maybe you're one of the folks who's been coming to church here for a while and you're ready to consider joining. I've actually made a case for why you should join our church this morning. Are you ready? I've got it in my notes. Hold on, let me get my glasses out. If you are feeling connected here and are hesitating to join, here's three reasons to join. To join signals your sense of belonging and publicly signifies your commitment. To join makes you known to the whole church and opens doors to new friendships. And to join enables you to participate more deeply in shaping and living out the mission of our church. So I invite you, now or another week, to join. Let us ponder our response. I'm happy to receive any response, including a request for prayer, as I stand at the front and we sing our invitation hymn.